Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When we listen on Audible, we are unconfined, free to travel the worlds inside our minds, where time moves faster, stops, rewinds. So let's walk and dance a mile in other shoes. Whatever's next is ours to choose. There's more to imagine when we listen. Audiobooks, podcasts, originals. Start listening now at Audible.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 31st of May, these are our main stories. The UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague has delivered the verdicts in its final major case, increasing the sentences of two Serbian security officials convicted of training death squads. A BBC investigation reveals new evidence of the trauma suffered by Ukrainian children removed to Russia, and Sudanese officials say they've suspended ceasefire talks with their paramilitary rivals. Also in this podcast, astronomers have detected a huge plume of water vapour spurting out from one of Saturn's moons.
What's surprising about this is just the size of it. You know, it's 20 times the size of the moon.
We begin in The Hague, where the UN War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia has delivered its last major verdict. It's increased prison sentences for two top former Serbian state security officials, Jovica Stanisic and Franko Simatovic, after a legal process lasting 2 decades. They'll serve 15 years instead of the 12 they were originally given. The two men are both in their 70s. From outside the court, our correspondent Anna Holligan told us about them and their crimes.
They're hugely significant because they were the link between the Serbian state infrastructure and the atrocities that were committed on the ground. So they were instrumental in setting up an armed police unit that was then deployed to commit murder, persecution, forcible transfer, and other crimes. And the reason why this matters so much is because, especially for the survivors who've come to The Hague to witness justice today, it means that there's no more denying that the government, the Serbian government under Slobodan Milosevic, was responsible for what the prosecution here called ethnic cleansing. Just as I came out of court a couple of hours ago, I spoke to a woman called Kada Hotic. She told me that she lost her two children, her brothers, in the Srebrenica massacre, and she was sitting in the sunshine, and she said, it's a beautiful day, it's a beautiful day for justice. And for them, you mentioned this is the final verdict in the final trial for this court, it also represents the final piece of the puzzle in linking the Serbian state to these atrocities.
And tell us a little bit more about the significance of this tribunal, because, as you say, this is the last major verdict. What's it achieved over the years?
It's so interesting because, you know, when prosecutors in other courts, politicians around the world talk about international justice, they often point to the success of this court, the Yugoslav tribunal, because it managed to indict and hold all of those indicted to account. And that's a record, an enviable record for many courts. But it's important to remember that that didn't happen in a vacuum. So there was regime change, there was huge international intervention, there was political willingness. And so although that's seen as a huge success, it wasn't down to the prosecutors here at the Yugoslav Tribunal alone. And the other thing is, some of the other survivors here have been telling me it's so important that these courts aren't just about bringing justice to the survivors, bringing those responsible to justice, but also in creating a historical record that can be used in the future to try to ensure that this kind of thing never happens again. And there are worries here among, for example, Kada Hotic, who say that people like Radovan Karadzic, the former political leader of the Bosnian Serbs, who was found guilty in this court, the former military leader, Radovan Karadzic, also found guilty by this court, by some people back in the Balkans, they're still seen as war heroes. And until that starts to change, until people see the kind of evidence that has been presented during the 30 years while this court has been operating, there are fears that the wounds caused by that conflict will never be fully healed.
That was Anna Holligan in The Hague. Russia has been accused of multiple war crimes in Ukraine since the start of its full-scale invasion. But it was allegations of the illegal deportation of children that led to an international arrest warrant being issued for Vladimir Putin himself. Ukraine now says more than 20,000 children have been removed to Russia, many from children's homes and special schools in occupied areas. Russia maintains it's evacuating them from danger. But our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford has been meeting some of the Ukrainian families affected, and she's found new evidence of how the children are treated.
As Sasha talks, he smooths his long fringe over his forehead repeatedly. He's telling me about the day that Russian soldiers came to his school in Kupiansk in northeastern Ukraine. They loaded him and 12 other Ukrainian children onto a bus and they drove off with them. Sasha was separated from his mother for 6 weeks.
To be honest, it's too distressing to even remember.
What happened to Sasha would be upsetting for any child, but he has special needs, and for someone so vulnerable, it was deeply unsettling. His mother then steps in to tell me the full story. It was last September, and Kupiansk was occupied then by the Russian military. Tatiana had sent Sasha to his special school in town, and then Ukraine's military began a surprise counteroffensive. Sasha disappeared. Tatiana was frantic until she eventually learned that her son was deep inside Russian-controlled territory and she could call him.
The children had been told their homes had gone, that everything had been destroyed, and Sasha was afraid we were gone too.
Tatiana was told that if she wanted her son back, she'd have to go and collect him. But that meant a grueling and frightening trip deep into enemy territory. It's stories like Sasha's that have got Vladimir Putin indicted as a suspected war criminal. Russia's president has been charged with the forced deportation of Ukrainian children. And it's all been done in plain sight. This is a video from the Telegram channel of Russia's children's ombudswoman. There are lots like this, and they show Maria Lvova-Belova delivering children from occupied areas of Ukraine into Russian families. Russia portrays its actions as humanitarian. Maria Lvova-Belova talks about saving children from Ukrainian Nazis. And she refers repeatedly to everything in occupied areas of Ukraine as Russian. We've discovered new evidence of how Ukrainian children are being treated. Sasha's mum, Tatiana, shows me photographs of her son's classmates dressed as Russian soldiers. One of them, a Ukrainian boy, has a Z patch on his arm. It's the mark of Russia's war on his country. The signs on the classroom wall show that the children were being made to celebrate a Russian military holiday.
I've got the phone number of the director of the home where Sasha was taken, so I'm going to call her and find out what she has to say about how he and the other children were treated there.
Hello, добрый день, Татьяна Викторовна.
I asked Tatiana Semyonova about those Z marks. So what? She snaps back. And soon after, the line cuts out. We've investigated multiple other cases, and we found similar threads each time. Russian denials, but Ukrainian lives disrupted, families torn apart. Sasha and his mum are now together again, living in Germany as refugees because their hometown, Kupiansk, is being pounded by Russia's military.
Sarah Rainsford. North Korea's attempt to launch its first satellite into space has ended in failure. It crashed into the sea. The launch triggered an early morning alert in Japan and South Korea, warning millions of people to seek cover. These people in Seoul gave their reaction to the warning.
I was very surprised and worried. I didn't know whether I had to flee Seoul. It seemed dangerous, but there was so little information.
I was scared, so I called my mom in tears. She said it was okay, so I fell back asleep. This did raise my awareness, and perhaps next time I will actually evacuate to a shelter.
The city's mayor has since apologised for the distress caused by the warning message. Our Seoul correspondent, Jean McKenzie, told us more about the satellite.
North Korea fired a missile this morning that was containing this spy satellite. Now, it was intended to go into space, to go into orbit, but the missile blew up and the spy satellite and the debris crashed into the sea, so it landed about 200 kilometres from Seoul. This is a big disappointment for Kim Jong-un. He has been planning to launch this spy satellite for a very long time. It's a piece of technology he's been working on now for more than 2 years, and it is on this weapons wish list that he created back in 2021. So today's failure is a big deal for the North Koreans.
And am I right in understanding that the South Koreans have recovered some pieces?
Yes, the South Korean military today has been on the site very quickly indeed, actually, and was able to take some of that debris and satellite out of the sea, because what it will be wanting to do is to work out how much progress North Korea had made and how sophisticated this satellite really was, because this is an important piece of kit. It would essentially give North Korea eyes in the sky over its so-called enemies, so over South Korea and the United States. So it would allow it to spot incoming attacks, but also to much more accurately plot its own attacks. And that's the important bit. At the moment, North Korea doesn't have a spy satellite, in contrast to countries like the US, China, Russia, Japan, that all have these satellites bearing down here on the Korean Peninsula observing things.
And tell us a little bit about what happened when the alarm was sounded.
So here in Seoul this morning, we were all jolted out of our sleep by an air raid siren, which is extremely rare here in Seoul. This is not something we're used to getting. In fact, most people here in Seoul may never have even heard an air raid siren before. And this was then followed by emergency messages being played out of loudspeakers telling people to prepare for an evacuation. But then 20 minutes later, we were all told that this had been a mistake. Honestly, people here have become so desensitized to the threat posed by North Korea over the years that when this siren went off, people didn't know what to do. They weren't prepared. We're kind of hearing people say this could go one of two ways. There are some people who've told us here today that actually it's made them think and they want to be far better prepared next time something happens and they're going to go away and make a plan. But the fear is that actually for those that already were a little complacent on this stuff, this false alarm might mean that next time people might be less likely to respond.
And just finally, Jean, there has been quite a strong response from the international community, hasn't there?
Yes, this has been condemned by Washington and, of course, here in South Korea and Japan. Even though this is part of North Korea's space program and it is a spy satellite, which other countries around the world have, North Korea is still banned under UN resolutions from launching this stuff because it still uses some of the same technology that its missiles uses. So it's with that that these countries are able to come and condemn North Korea for essentially breaking UN rules. And this piece of technology, people don't want North Korea to have it because it would make North Korea more dangerous because it could plot those more accurate attacks.
That was Jean McKenzie in Seoul. Sudanese officials say the army has suspended ceasefire talks with the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, accusing the group of repeatedly violating previous truce agreements. Will Ross reports.
Commenting on the decision to pull out of the talks, a Sudanese government official put all the blame on the Rapid Support Forces, accusing them of failing to follow the rules of the ceasefire. He said the RSF had broken its commitment to withdraw from hospitals and residential areas. But both sides are to blame. The Sudanese army never stopped the aerial bombardment of areas around Khartoum. The talks brokered by Saudi Arabia and the US have enabled some humanitarian aid to be given out, but the hope was that the mediation would eventually bring about a permanent ceasefire. Without the talks, there's a danger of the fighting escalating into an even more deadly and destructive civil war.
That was Will Ross. Now, this might sound like a good idea, using fat from pigs and other animals to make greener jet fuel in order to reduce the carbon footprint by airlines. But environmental campaigners say the surging demand for this type of fuel from animal byproducts is unsustainable and will end up being worse for the planet. We heard more from our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
animal byproducts have been used for centuries by people to make candles and cosmetics and soaps, but it's over the last 20 years or so they've really become a force in energy and transport as they've been turned into biofuels for use in cars and trucks. And this has, I guess, crept up on consumers. People haven't really realised, because most of the effort has gone into using used cooking oils and other waste products, but animal fats are considered a waste product and therefore they are seen as beneficial in carbon terms, and companies and fuel sellers have been turning to them in greater numbers. In fact, the amount of animal fats used in biofuels across Europe has doubled over the last 10 years.
So it's not a fossil fuel. It is, as you say, a byproduct. What seems to be the problem?
It's not a fossil fuel. It is actually a byproduct. It is classed as waste. But essentially, the numbers of animals that are supplying this material that are killed every year and slaughtered isn't increasing. So there's a finite supply. And at the moment, a lot of these waste animal products are used for many other things, particularly pet food. And the worry is that if the aviation industry starts to turn to this type of fuel and they have the deep pockets to afford it, they're being put under pressure by governments to really clean up their act when it comes to fossil fuels, then those other companies that use this material, such as pet foods, will have to turn to something else. And possibly the most likely thing they will turn to is palm oil. And palm oil leads to deforestation and actually increases emissions. And the calculation that's been done on this report indicates that if you go over to animal fats in a big way, you could actually drive up emissions and not down, as other companies will turn to alternatives because they won't be able to afford animal fats for their needs.
As you say, airlines are under pressure to reduce their carbon footprint. These sorts of policies, these sorts of solutions, they seem to be just tinkering at the edges, don't they?
In many ways, I can see why policymakers would go for something like this. You take a waste product and you essentially do something useful with it. So it's potentially a good idea, as it does reduce the amount of carbon in the fuel tank. But the unintended consequences are the things that are the real world applications of this. And because markets are so big and powerful and the needs for these type of products are so wide, it's been difficult for policymakers to see what would happen here. And now they're getting warnings from all sorts that this is actually what's going to happen. You're going to divert some of this material that's being used in a cyclical way in pet foods into fuel, and that is going to lead to other consequences. So it's understandable that they would try to use waste. They just haven't seen all the consequences. Now they've put in place legislation to really force airlines to go down this road, and that could really make things very difficult and actually make things essentially worse than they are already.
And for people who were unaware that this is becoming more prominent in aviation, are you suggesting that vegans should all just stop flying?
It is going to be a challenge, I think. I think it's been used in transport and in cars for a number of years, so people who are vegan or vegetarian who might be concerned about the use of animal products probably have been, unknown to themselves, using these materials. But I think it may pose a challenge for airlines going forward if it becomes a problem that vegans don't want to fly on planes that are powered by animal fats.
That was Matt McGraw. Still to come.
He's beautiful, but a little bit weird. Totally white and red eyes.
Alvinho, a rare giant albino anteater in Brazil.
Fukushima, an original audio drama series from the BBC World Service, telling the story of the 2011 disaster at Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant.
There is no greater threat we face at this time than the one unfolding in Fukushima Daiichi.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And we're back. Tara Reid is an American who used to work for Joe Biden back when he was a senator. She came into the news in 2020 when she accused Mr. Biden of sexually assaulting her. He vehemently denied it had ever happened. Well, now Ms. Reid has popped up in Russia and announced she wants to live there and take Russian citizenship. Our Europe regional editor Paul Moss told us more about Tara Reid.
She describes herself now as a geopolitical analyst, though it's not clear if she was ever actually employed in that capacity. But yes, she found fame in 2020. Joe Biden was the candidate for president. And in a podcast, Tara Reid described how back when he was just a Miss Senator from Delaware, and she was a 29-year-old staffer. Joe Biden had pushed her against a wall and assaulted her. Now, her husband said he did remember her telling him about it. She says she made a formal complaint at the time, but no record was ever found. And as you say, Joe Biden repeatedly denied this. Bear in mind, this was when Joe Biden was facing Donald Trump as his opponent, who had multiple accusations of sexual assault and rape against him. Critics say this was an attempt to make his opponent seem similarly compromised. But the story was never substantiated. It went away. But now here, Tara Reid is back again in the spotlight, but for very different reasons.
And why is it that she says she wants to live in Russia?
Well, perhaps surprisingly, she says she originally only went to Russia on holiday, but got off the plane and felt safe and happy. Some background, though. There had been a suggestion recently that Tara Reid might bring up those sexual assault allegations again in the lead up to the next US presidential election. She says she was threatened, and if she did this, she could end up dead, hence feeling safer in Russia. But she also says she's enjoying her time in Moscow. I should say I've been in Moscow in late spring. It's lovely. You know, the snow's nice, has melted. There are flowers in bloom. Just wait till she gets to December and see if she feels the same way. But she is undoubtedly trying to keep her options open. Here's what she had to say speaking at a news conference.
I do promise to be a good citizen, and I promise to move forward with my life in a positive way. And, you know, I hope to also have my American citizenship, because the whole thing is my Russian brothers and sisters, I just want to thank you for your warmth and for your kindness and for opening your heart to me when at a very scary time. Спасибо.
And Paul, do you think she's going to be allowed to stay?
Well, Russia has always loved its defectors and Westerners who say they support Russia. You know, look at the welcome given to the action film star Steven Seagal. He expressed his support for Putin, went to Moscow, and President Putin gave him a medal. More seriously, there was Edward Snowden, who ran away there mainly because he faced arrest. Tara Reid insists she's not impulsive, but likes to analyse the data points. Now, I've got to admit, I'm not quite sure what that means, but we will have to wait and see where those data points lead her.
Paul Moss, our Europe regional editor. Now, you might have heard in our last podcast about warnings by a group of artificial intelligence experts that the technology could be capable of making humanity extinct. Now, one of the godfathers of AI, Joshua Benjo, said he would have prioritised safety over usefulness had he realised the pace at which it would evolve. Mr. Benjo has been speaking to our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
It is challenging, emotionally speaking, for people who are inside, especially if, like myself, you build your career, your identity around the idea of, you know, bringing something useful and good to society and to humanity and to science. But it's not the first time that scientists go through these emotions. Think about Second World War and the atom bomb, right? There are lots of analogies there.
Do you feel sad about it?
I feel like, you know, what used to be simple, what gave a meaning to my life and a direction and was clear, isn't anymore. So you could say I feel lost. But in those cases, you have to keep going and you have to engage, discuss, think, encourage others to think with you. Society needs, we need to think together through what are the best options without leaving all of the other dangers that we, other threats that societies face.
What do you think is the best way to regulate the sector?
The thing you want to avoid for pretty much all of the risks is the free-for-all, right? So we need companies that are building powerful AI systems to be registered. Governments need to track what they're doing. They need to be able to audit them. And that's just like a minimum thing we do for any other sector, like, you know, building airplanes or cars or pharmaceuticals, right? I think we also need the people who are close to these systems to have a kind of certification. So think about doctors. They have like an ethical training. And we need ethical training here. Computer scientists usually don't get that, by the way. We also need to do a lot more research to better understand the potentially dangerous scenarios so that we can build both the technical and the policy guardrails.
That was Joshua Bengio, Professor of Computer Science at the University of Montreal. Astronomers have detected a huge plume of water vapour spurting out from one of Saturn's moons. Scientists are fascinated by the moon Enceladus because it could hold the basic conditions to support life. The plume, which reached around 9,000 kilometres into space, was detected by the James Webb Telescope. Professor Catherine Haymans, the Astronomer Royal for Scotland, spoke to Martha Carney about the sighting.
This moon Enceladus, it's only 300 miles across. It's created this massive plume of icy water particles and some other particles out into space. Now, we've known about these plumes coming off the south pole of Enceladus for a long while, ever since the Cassini mission went up in 2005. But what's surprising about this is just the size of it. You know, it's 20 times the size of the moon. So we're having to rethink what's causing these geysers that are coming out. There are four cracks, we call them tiger stripes, on the southern pole that produce these water plumes. And this first image was a big surprise, just how big this particular plume was that they imaged.
Obviously, water is essential for life. And is that one of the reasons why people think of Enceladus as one of the most promising places to find life beyond Earth?
For life, you of course need water. You need some sort of organic material, which have also been found in this plume, and you need some sort of heat source. Now, this is what's interesting about Enceladus, is the idea is that there are these underwater vents. So there's an ocean underneath this icy core. Like the temperature on the surface of this moon is -200 degrees Celsius, so it's freezing cold. But at the core, I think it's hot enough to heat up this water, and that's what's causing these plumes to come out. And we know deep in our own ocean, on planet Earth, in these sort of conditions, life can survive. So that's why we're excited to see these big plumes. It will help us understand a bit more what's going on and how likely it is that life could exist. But it's not going to be life like you and me, deep sea bacteria. So that's exciting. Now, NASA is planning a mission to go and check this out in more detail. So there's a $5 billion mission planned called the Enceladus Orbilander. And the secret's in the name then. So it will orbit these plumes for about a year and a half, sampling the chemicals in them, and then actually land on the moon. But unfortunately, you're going to have to wait until about 2050 before this happens.
Professor Catherine Haymans. And staying with space, because we don't just throw this thing together, a privately funded mission to the International Space Station has ended with a successful splashdown off the coast of Florida. A SpaceX capsule carrying two American and two Saudi astronauts parachuted into the Gulf of Mexico.
Peggy, John, Ollie, Rihanna, on behalf of SpaceX, welcome home.
Well, in SpaceX, we would like to tell you that was a phenomenal ride. We really enjoyed all of it.
The team carried out research on board the space station for 8 days. It was the second such trip by the company Axiom Space and included the first Saudi woman to go into orbit, Rihanna Barnawi. And finally, let's hear about Alvin, the world's only known albino giant anteater who has just recently been discovered. Standing out from the crowd might have its advantages, but in the animal kingdom, it can be risky. Alvin, or Alvino, as he is affectionately called, is being closely monitored by conservationists in Brazil. Victoria Uwanhunda found out more by speaking to the vet, Dr. Deborah Yogi, from the Anteaters and Highways Project in Campo Grande, Brazil.
Alvino was discovered last year in August by the ranch workers, the cowboys. They were working in the pasture and they saw the mother with normal dark colors carrying a white baby. They took lots of pictures and they sent me these pictures. And I thought, we can't miss this opportunity. Let's go to the field right now. Let's find this rare animal. It's unique, Alvino and his maybe brother, they are the first albino giant anteaters in the world. It's super rare. They are the first. Last year, we found another albino in the same farm. Maybe they are brothers. That albino, We found his carcass in the field. Probably it was predation.
So what's Alvinio like?
He's beautiful, but a little bit weird. Totally white. And Alvinio has red eyes. He's beautiful with that white colors walking in the savannah.
Why is he an albino? Why is Alvinio albino?
It's super rare, but becomes more frequent in small populations with higher inbreeding rates. We know that the giant anteater population is declining, and because of this, they are in danger. In our region, they face high levels of deforestation, habitat degradation, and road kills. And Alvinio highlights that conservation measures here are needed.
And so what implications does his albinism have on his life there in the wild?
With this white color, he's less able to camouflage in the landscape. So we know that he's more prone to predation. In the wild, they can live about 15 years. And with the GPS harness, we are being able to study how the albinism affects his life. We can track his movements. We can follow him and to see how he uses the landscape. So for us, it's incredible.
Deborah, we've been talking about a one-year-old giant albino anteater. And I think in the background, I could hear a baby. Is that your baby?
Oh, sorry. Yes, I have a 6-month baby.
Oh, fantastic. Boy or girl?
Yes. Boy. Martin is the name.
Do you hope that he will grow up to follow in your footsteps and find it maybe many more Alvinios in the future?
Yes, I hope to present Alvinio to my baby.
Veterinarian Dr. Deborah Yogi of the Anteaters and Highways Project in Brazil. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. That works for Happy Pod contributions as well. And you can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes Porter, and the producer was Tracy Gordon. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye. Thank you.